Just as kids first learn to draw before they tackle complex forms of communication, the early human attempts at passing information first took the form of paintings, intricate symbols on cave walls, that now we study to learn how our ancestors communicated with each other and how they wrote the stories of their lives. Imagine now, thousands of years from today, future humans looking back on the way we communicate and reducing our life stories to LOLs, emoji smiley faces, and fighting with each other through computer screens. Just as cave drawings surely didn't fully capture the lives of ancient humans in Paleolithic times, surely we too are more than just the sum of our Facebook posts. Surely they searched for meaning, had fears and joys, loves and triumphs, just as we do now. But what if we could foster more meaningful dialogue with each other through the platforms we use to communicate and in the way we leave the daily trail of breadcrumbs in our life stories? From communication styles taking center stage in our assessments of candidates this presidential election to the vast array of communication tools and platforms in the media landscape, so much of our modern world is built on communication. When we look at the history of modern technology and major developments on this timeline, many are directly related to communication. The telegraph, the telephone, radio, TV, all the way to Twitter, Facebook, and Snapchat. Tonight, we're looking at the topic of communication, from platforms and technological advances to communication styles and narratives we hear and sometimes further without even realizing it. And certainly, we'll be taking a look and talking a lot about the way we communicate with each other, especially in an election year. Many say that the world is divided and dangerous, and that rhetoric widens this divide by the day. And that might be the case, but my friends, that is another show for another night. Tonight, we'll consider this big question. What if we put our minds to the task of learning how to better communicate across all platforms in order to have meaningful and productive conversations with each other about the big topics instead of this verbal tug of war through computer screens, each side desperately aiming at the impossible task of trying to convince each other of what is right? What if we took a different approach, one that wasn't about being right, but instead was about moving the needle towards a common purpose? Impossible? Hardly. I'm Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special on WGN. Tonight's episode, Communication.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, you heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for being with us tonight and spending part of your Saturday evening with me. I'm so honored that you're doing so and very grateful to you for that. Well, so tonight's show is indeed all about communication. We're going to be talking about tools and platforms, all the way up to communication styles and popular narratives, and into the way that we communicate with each other, especially in an election year, because I think we can all agree it is not pretty out there. So we've got some good guests, really good guests, joining us throughout the program tonight. Our regular contributor and good friend of the show, Dr. John Duffy, is here, and he will be hanging out with us because we like to bring him in anytime we ask the question, what makes people act that way? He is excellent at answering that question, so we have him in to hang out with us tonight. We also are going to be talking with a Columbia University expert in the narratives in the media and all the media platforms about how different groups of people are depicted and why it matters to point attention to that and to examine that and to consider that. And we will also hear from another regular contributor to the show and another friend of the program, and that is our good friend Rex Hubke from the Chicago Tribune. He is fresh from the Republican convention in Cleveland. He is caught up on sleep, and he will be joining us a little bit later in the show to talk specifically about how we talk to each other about politics. So My friends, stick around. Lots to do tonight. Esteemed producer Rachel Woodall, a little tongue-tied over your name tonight. Sorry about that. Will be the voice on the other end of the line when you call tonight. 312-981-7200. And I encourage you to call in and share your comments throughout the show. I always love hearing from you, and I always really, really appreciate very thoughtful dialogue with lots and lots of different points of view attached. I especially want to hear stories of triumph in communication, something that you do that is especially effective or an epiphany that you had with communication. I especially want to hear those stories. But you can always also find me on Twitter and Facebook and all other communication platforms as we're talking about tonight, and we can continue this conversation by social media. If you're feeling a little shy and don't want to call in, that's okay. We can talk there too. So we'll be right back in just a bit to get this conversation underway about communication on 720 WGN.
1984, we introduced the Macintosh. It didn't just change Apple, it changed the whole computer industry. In 2001, we introduced the first iPod, and it didn't just change the way we all listen to music. It changed the entire music industry. Today, we're introducing three revolutionary products of this class. A widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device. An iPod. A phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device, and we are calling it iPhone.
WGN. It's a Saturday night special. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking all about communication tonight. And that clip of Steve Jobs, those Apple announcement events are always such a big to-do. There's so much interest in them. And some of them have really changed the course of history. I mean, when he's talking about, you know, this, like, think about when the iPod first came out. That just really revolutionized things. And then the iPad and the iPhone and all the everything. It's been so interesting to follow all the things. And the iWatch, right? All those things. So we're talking all about communication tonight, particularly platforms, communication styles, the way we talk to each other, with special attention paid to civility and presence and meaning and the way we talk to each other, especially in an election year, because I think we can all agree, no matter how you're going to vote or not vote in November, even though I want you to vote, but however, whatever your plan is in November, I think we can all agree it's not pretty out there and it's not very civilized. And if what we're doing on Twitter and Facebook today will be the way we think of cave symbols of our ancestors, if future humans are going to look back at us in that way, they're going to think we're a bunch of jerks. And I don't want that. And I'm sure you don't want that either. So we're going to be talking all about that tonight. We are joined by frequent contributor of this program and our good friend, Dr. John Duffy. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Amy Guth. It's great to be here.
Always happy to have you here. And as I said in the last segment, we like to call you in when we ask the question, what makes people act that way? Because you're so good at explaining that for us. And we always appreciate your very thoughtful, wonderful insight. And so communication is a big topic.
It is.
And it's hard to know where to start with it because it really spans so much stuff.
Right.
But, you know, one thing that I have been thinking about quite a bit is both the style we communicate with each other, regardless of platform. And I've told this story many times on this station because it's so powerful to me and it played such a big role in my life. And that is my grandfather, who is a very smart guy and has seen a lot of things in 100 years of his life and still completely with it. He has asked me many times about social media, and I have, shown him.
Right.
And the first time I showed him social media, he got very excited and said that he saw, like, oh, this is like telegrams, and this is like, Twitter was a telegram to him, which I think is a pretty good way to say that.
Yeah.
But then he said, oh, this is a return to the person-to-person business model, when I knew a human being was going to hear me. And it wasn't a recording and it wasn't someone on the other side of the world. It was a human being. And I thought that was so powerful. And it really has always driven the way that I conduct conversations on social media. And it's never been lost on me that there's a human being on the other side of that account. And I think that matters. And when we talk about incivility, especially online, I think we are quick to say, well, that's somebody in a basement in his underwear. Who, nah, nah, nah.
Right.
But nonetheless, I think we have, I would go so far as to say, a public health crisis on our hands with the way we treat each other online. What would you think about that?
A really, really powerful way to put it. I think there's that ability to be so anonymous online, and so the name calling and the bullying, sometimes that lowest common denominator just rises to the surface. And when we think about social media, it feels, and I think you've said this before, like this enormous opportunity to connect in a completely different
totally.
Way. We're not always going to have this opportunity to talk to somebody on the other side of the world, but through Twitter, somehow we can have that discussion. And too often we devolve, right? Mm-hmm. We devolve the way we converse with each other when we have this opportunity to really up the ante and to connect with people, learn from people. But I think too often we all want to be heard and validated. But I think maybe too often on social media, we want to be correct and we want to pontificate and we want to tell people how to feel instead of, you know, letting that be a learning forum for other people and for ourselves.
Truly, truly. Yeah. It reminds me of, and we talk about this a lot. I do the work that I do at the Op-Ed Project. We talk about this a lot, but I've followed this linguist for a very long time, but we talk about his work there. And that's George Lakoff, who talks about the frames and the filters by which we communicate with the world. And he often makes the point that we're speaking two different languages when we're arguing with somebody. And I think that is so clear in an election year, right? And if you take it issue by issue, and if you're looking at like about guns, one side is talking about rights. The other one is talking about safety. That's not even the same conversation.
Right.
And so we end up just like screaming at each other and saying awful things and unfollowing each other. And I think it's becoming, I mean, that part worries me deeply because I think that we can't, it's beyond just the art of dialogue is lost. It's something more serious that we cannot deal and we just have to shut it down.
You're right. It's not just the art of dialogue. It is about talking different languages and not recognizing that in real time. And so we end up arguing about things that aren't even really related. It becomes way too often in almost any campaign issue we can find an apples versus oranges debate that people are having out there, and that I fear about the debates coming up, that it's going to devolve into an apples and oranges debate, and we're never really going to talk about in a civil way about, like, you know, how do you feel about this? How do I feel about this? Is there room in the middle anywhere for this? You know what I mean? Is there any room to learn from each other? Is there any room for anybody to say, you know what, that's a pretty good point. I'll integrate that into my thinking.
Right.
You just don't hear that much anymore.
I think even the way we start conversations online, right? We don't start with, like, if you make a point and I don't agree, instead of saying, I hear you.
Right.
Maybe consider this also. From my point of view, I see this thing you're missing, which would be something in my mind would lead to productive conversation. People go, well, actually. And I feel like anytime you need to start a conversation or a comment with the word actually, you're saying, by virtue of using that word, you're saying, you are wrong, listen to the correct thing I'm about to say.
Right, right. I always think, maybe this is just an occupational hazard in terms of therapy language, and that always starts with validating somebody else's point of view. Mm-hmm. People aren't going onto Facebook or onto Twitter to express an opinion just to do so. So there's probably some validity. There's a reason, whether it's emotional or whether there's data behind it. There's a reason that they're expressing what they feel. And if we just dismiss it and say something like, well, yeah, but, or, you know, something truly dismissive and then move on to the point we want to make, well, we're not having a discussion at all. We're really just saying, I'm going to up the ante and I'm going to prove to you that I'm right and you're wrong. And that I don't think is the intent of any kind of discourse, and in particular ought not be the intent of social media, because if it is now, I feel like we're just at the advent of this thing. We're just getting started, right?
Right?
So I don't know what this looks like, you know,
terrifying.
Two election cycles down the road, you know, where we've got holograms, you know, arguing with each other.
Right.
I don't know what it looks like.
Yeah.
But not good.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, I've gotten, obviously I bring up big topics on this show and the time that I've been, the years I've been on WGN, I'm, I'm willing to, I want to talk about big things. And, and a couple of times people have accused me of, they're like, you bring these things up because you want to make your point and you want to convert people to your way of thinking. That could not be further from the truth. In fact, I bring up big things because I want to talk about them.
Right.
And that's why I always say, I want your calls. I want diversity of opinion. I want it to be kind and thoughtful.
Yeah.
I don't want you to just like call me an idiot because that, what's that going to do?
Right.
Oh,
right.
I am. Thank you. I'll leave now. Like, what am I?
Well, that harsh edge is something that I think has to go too, because the whole kind and thoughtful element, and maybe, well, I think maybe we like to blame it on this election cycle, but I think this election cycle is an artifact of of a lot of unkindness.
Well, but and we'll talk about this a little bit later. We're going to be talking with Rex Hupke later in the program, who was at the RNC and has been covering this election year. But I think, in a way, this election cycle has given kind of permission for a lot of things to be said that weren't necessarily, I think they were being said, but I think they were maybe not as openly aired.
Right, behind closed doors a little
bit. Yeah, and but it's also brought up an interesting conversation about we look at our candidates and their communication styles. I mean, we look at even nonverbal cues. Like there was... If you Google Hillary Clinton and smiling, there was a lot of journalism hours were devoted to talking about whether or not she's smiling and whether or not her voice sounds off-putting.
Right.
And whether or not Donald Trump is saying hateful things. And I mean, a lot of what we're talking about this election is about the candidate's communication.
It really is. And you're right. There's nothing more powerful, really, than that nonverbal communication. You know, it really tells a story well beyond what a candidate or an individual you're sitting across from is saying. I think we all know when somebody is open, when somebody's present and available and open to other points of view and really wants to have a discussion, even if it's a disagreement.
Yeah.
And we can also tell when the opposite's going on. That difficult to
right.
discern.
We sniff it out right away.
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
away.
Right.
So do you think, on a more positive note, though, do you think that social media is a useful tool for introverts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have the luxury and the privilege of working with a lot of people who happen to be introverted or ambiverted. And
define ambiverted.
Ambiverted is kind of a cross between introversion and extroversion.
Okay.
And most people who call themselves ambiverts lean toward introversion. In other words, they get their energy from being alone. You know, that's where they recharge their batteries, but they can be out there. And you know, a lot of people, I would guess, in this business are ambiverts, so that they can be out here and they can take the microphone for a few hours and then they need some decompression time. I don't know if you're one of those people.
I'm definitely one of those people. And it's funny because I think the popular narrative is that introversion has something to do with shyness.
Right.
And it doesn't.
Not at all.
I'm not shy. I'll talk to anybody about anything.
Right.
I'll walk up to a stranger and put a microphone in their face.
Right.
But if I don't give myself time, a little yoga time, a little decompression time, it is not good.
Yeah, I think it has to do with where you recharge your batteries.
Yeah.
Judgment-free, you know, and some people recharge their batteries at a dinner party, you know, and can be feel like, you know, I need people around me. I want activity around me. I want kids around me. And I feel, you know, recharged. But for introverts, I think it's I need time to just sit and read and decompress and consider, you know, and, you know, not only should that be judgment free, but there's a book called Quiet Out. It came out a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's an excellent book.
Oh, it's such a great book.
By Susan Cain. That's
yes,
a great
exactly.
Book. Yeah.
Right. Right. And just talks about the power of the introvert and how, you know, the extroverts of the world really wouldn't do very well without some of those introverts, you know, kind of weighing in.
And it's got the best subtitle. I'm looking it up right now, but I think it's about something in a world that won't shut up. That's the best part of the subtitle.
It is.
I highly recommend that book.
Really great book.
It is a very, very good
yes.
book. But I think it's been, it's interesting to me, the gift of social media for introverts, because I think it allows a little bit of this ambivert beat where you can be alone and chill, but check in.
Yes.
And feel connected to the world. Because I think the downside sometimes of introversion is that it can be isolating.
I agree completely. And I love the idea. And I think a lot of people are slow to comprehend the idea that this is a way of connecting. Social media is a way of genuinely connecting with other people, with a community of people, with an individual person. I think oftentimes we see somebody who's sitting on their iPad and we think, oh, they're disconnected. They need to be out there in the world
right.
with other people face to face. And that's a wonderful thing. And I think it's important in everybody's life. But I think a lot of people can gain their connections via social media. I think it's an enormous gift and an enormous tool, especially for people who tend toward introversion.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a, and we got to take a break here in a sec, but there was a picture I saw recently taken at the back of a train car. It was a commuter train car, and the photo was taken in the 50s going into New York City. And it was, it said something like, yeah, no one looks up on trains anymore. Everybody has their head down in there. In whatever they're reading, but it's a picture of all businessmen reading newspapers. So it's like, well, are we really that different? Are we still kind of, it's a buffer between us and the world. It's a way we're connecting to something on the other side of the world, which I thought was an interesting comparison.
Definitely.
My friends, we're talking with our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, and we're talking about communication tonight, from platforms to styles to all of the big topics we're wrestling with right now in this election cycle and how we communicate with each other about them. Lots and lots of stuff to get into tonight. And of course, we welcome your calls, 312-981-7200. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Can you hear me now? Good. Can you hear me now?
How do you build America's Good. Largest wireless network?
Can you hear me now? Good.
By never being satisfied.
Can you hear me now? Good.
Until no matter where you go.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Your call goes through.
Can you hear me now? Good.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. That was a classic communications ad right there, the Can You Hear Me Now? Interestingly, that actor is now appearing on a different phone company commercial right now, talking like he's owning it, though, and he's talking about, I used to be the guy that asked, can you hear me now? But we're talking all about communications tonight and the many, many styles of communication, the complexities that arise when we think about communicating with each other, especially in an election year, and especially when we start talking about all the different platforms that we have to communicate with each other on, because that's when it gets really tricky, because there's a lot coming at us. There's a lot just sitting in our phones, in our pockets, and in our purses. There's half a dozen ways to communicate right there. And sometimes what we're trying to say doesn't always come through, right? Sometimes you, I think we've all misfired a text message and then, oh, no, that's not what I meant. I was being serious. I wasn't joking or whatever. And lots of stuff comes up when we think and talk about communication. So we have our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, with us tonight because we love his insight and appreciate his thoughtful take on all things about humans and why we act the way we do. So it's always a joy to have you with us. Well, I want to talk about one subject that you talk about a lot and you've written about a lot when we talk about communicating with each other, and that is about being present.
Yeah.
In particular, on your website, if you go to drjohnduffy.com, you can see a lot of great stuff that you've written, and there's your especially you've written a lot about communicating with your children.
Yeah.
And in those family relationships that are the ones that drive us the most crazy when they're not working but are so fulfilling when they're working well. But a word that you use a lot is present. And I think that's a really important one because of all of the distractions that we have, because of all the stuff around us, because of every little ding on our phone is potentially a hit of dopamine for us, you know?
Right.
And we're
right.
So like looking every direction and sometimes don't know where to look. And we're, I mean, just the other day I read something about the average number of brands we see in a given day. And it was in the thousands, just in the day.
Wow.
I mean, that's a lot of attention that's being pulled in a lot of different directions.
Right, right.
And so I have to think it's harder than ever to be fully present. And I don't mean just like having your phone out on a date or at dinner or something, although that's a problem too. But I just think that it's so easy to be distracted now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, there our attention is so fragmented. And so we stop to think about, you know, okay, well, what does it mean to be present? And there's these techniques around that, you know, oh, I'm going to do active listening. I'm going to nod. I'm going to validate. I'm going to make eye contact. I'm going to have open body language. But being present is way more than that. You know, it's really you feel it when somebody is present with you, when you're kind of wrapped in a conversation with somebody and you know you're communicating on a level beyond just the intellectual. We talk about different planes of communication, and there's, you know, intellectual and cognitive planes, but there's also kind of a deeper emotional plane. And I think when we talk about being present, it's when we're connecting with somebody on a deeper emotional plane. And I don't know if I can tell somebody exactly how to get there. I think we all know it when we're when we're in it, because it's one of those things where we're in the zone, time's passing, and we're just enjoying our time with somebody, even if we're disagreeing with them.
Right.
So I do know that it is one of the most important things we can do, because I think we so want other people to bear witness to our lives, and we want to do that for other people. And so the best way to do that is to work to be present for them. And in the things I've written, the elements that I always want to take away are fear and judgment and ego. And if you can take those three pieces away, and that's asking the world of anybody who's trying to communicate anything, but if you can minimize those three elements of the way you communicate, then you have this opportunity to be present. If they're there, I think it's almost impossible.
And how do you even begin to do that?
I think you have to be aware of it. You have to recognize I am afraid a lot of the time when I'm communicating with somebody. My ego does play a role when I'm communicating with somebody. I'm looking to win something, or I'm looking to, you know, beat them in some way. In terms of judgment, I think we have to recognize, and this is true for parents more than anybody, sometimes I'm judging other people, and that isn't my place. You know what I mean? Because everybody has something to say that's relevant, and the more judgmental we are, the more removed we are from being present. So I think the main way to do it is to recognize I'm fearful, I'm judgmental, and I'm ego-filled, and the more I can step back from those, the more I can be present with this person. If you can admit that to yourself, which is big, and it's there all the time for all of us. So, you know, no shame for anybody, so we can take that out of it.
Yeah.
But if you can remove those, man, you can be present. And as a parent and as a therapist, these things are critical. I mean, being present is everything, and it's where the joy is in our lives, right? Because if we're not present for something, if we're afraid about the future, if we're worried about the past, if we're dwelling somewhere else, well, then we're missing it.
Yeah.
And I always, that's my biggest worry for people is, you know, I don't want you to miss your lives. I don't want it to pass by because you're not there.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting you say it's hard to define, but then once you nail it, you know.
Yeah.
That's so true. And I'm thinking of times when you accidentally do it, right? When you meet somebody and you have a really deep and interesting conversation because you just, you know, and we dismiss it as, oh, we just click.
Right.
But in fact, you were probably just very present, probably looking through similar filters of life and things like that.
Right.
And I think a lot of times as I'm reflecting on my own life, the times where I've done that and really felt like I've really just clicked or made a new friend on the spot or something like that usually has something to do with speaking a common language, having a common goal, a shared history of something like you know, we both saw something crazy happen, or, you know, I've heard of people bonding after being stuck in an elevator.
Right.
Things like that. You bond over that.
Absolutely.
But also I think in particular, I'm thinking of one friend. We started our very first conversation with she kind of confessed what she thought was a flaw. And I go, oh, I do that too. And I think there's a little bit of power. And suddenly it was a very non-judgmental conversation because here we were both saying like, oh, you do that too. I do that. Oh, I hear you. And immediately we kind of validated each other.
Yeah, I think when we're willing to be vulnerable to one another, Brené Brown has done great work around this issue of vulnerability. And, you know, I think historically we've all thought, especially my gender, less than yours, but that vulnerability is this grand weakness that we carry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so we've got to suppress that. When in fact, I think she points out very appropriately, that's where our biggest strengths are. And that's our ability to connect is when we're vulnerable with one another. Like, you know, yeah, I feel that way too, you know, and there suddenly you've got this connection with this person that would have been missed otherwise.
You know, interesting you say that, because I also think I think the vulnerability to men is nice to women.
Ha.
You know what I mean? I think like it's become a bad word, right? Like men don't like generally, I think, struggle with vulnerability because it seems like it might be a sense of weakness. Whereas women, I think somewhere nice got the bad word. They're like, oh, she's so nice. Meaning she's a pushover. She's a doormat.
Right,
she can stand up for herself.
Yeah, right.
Which I think has become this very loaded word for both genders.
Right. Probably not the right the right appropriation for either, right? It doesn't mean the right thing for either gender because nice suggests something less than strong, right?
Yeah.
I mean, right, there's not much strength in the word nice.
I've stopped using that word completely because I think it's so loaded for people.
Yeah.
Because what I really mean, though, is I usually mean kind.
And that's a powerful word.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a very powerful word.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes another interesting word related to that is civility, which I think sometimes people think means if you're being civil, you have to be nice and bend to someone else's will.
Right.
Because I think then nice gets tangled back up into it.
Yeah.
When, oh my gosh, we need so much civility, even in the way we disagree, especially in the way we disagree.
And that's where I think all of this presence in particular gets real tricky, right? I want to be kind. I want to be civil. And yet, man, I think you're wrong.
But
man,
boy,
I'm right about this, you know? And to pull that all together is a tricky thing to do.
Do you think that communication styles are they cyclical? Are they cultural? Do you think we swing in different directions and then kind of come back to a more civilized place?
Definitely.
Go back to a mean place?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's absolutely true. I think people's styles shift within themselves, can shift in different settings. I think we were kind of alluding to that earlier. I think there are times when it's appropriate to have certain communication styles. I was at a dinner party last night, and we were planning a vacation for some men, myself included, and our sons. And there were a bunch of different styles, and I have this style that's kind of touchy-feely. Well, how do you guys feel about, if we all took a midnight cruise together or something like that? Whereas there was another guy who was just seething, and he said, well, wait a minute, who's bringing the food? You know,
the important things.
Right. So I think, balance in different types of communication mm-hmm. styles is important within us too, and I think
yeah.
we probably all have these propensities. We lean in certain directions, but we don't function very well if we don't tap into all different types of communication, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. That's taxing. That's a big task.
Yeah.
Like, especially if you're talking to a lot of people, because I feel like something I ask of myself is I'm always, if someone kind of rubs me the wrong way or they say something that offends me, I immediately ask myself, okay, what are they really saying here? What is this really about? You know, this isn't about something got messed up in the office. This is about their fear of looking bad, or they don't want the boss to think they did it, or this is really about fear or
right.
insecurity. This isn't about whether or not this TPS report got filled. That's a lot to ask of each other, but I think, I don't know, tell me what you think, but it seems like we're going to have to do something, because we've gotten in a way that we're not communicating very civilizedly to each other.
right.
I think the pendulum is in a direction where even when people are friendly and joking with each other, I think some of the things are kind of hateful. I really don't love it when I hear people go, shut up. Like,
oh,
they're
right.
kidding. They mean, no way, that's incredible. But they're like, shut up.
Oh, right. Even that new vernacular of yeah. that playful way of saying, shut up. You've got to be
right,
kidding me.
Right. I think
yeah.
even playful things have got sound kind of mean and
yeah.
aggressive. And I'm not trying to be two seashells and wind chimes here, but I think it's a bigger deal than we make of it.
I do too. And I'll tell you, just if we want an umbrella to put some of this, this discussion and the presence and the civility, I always think about emotional intelligence, and it's a concept I adore since I first heard about it. And it's really about not just understanding kind of like pragmatically, what are we talking about here, but also trying to get like, okay, how do I feel about this? Like just checking in, like, how do
yeah.
I feel about this? Something about this rubs me the wrong way, or this feels perfectly right to me. How does this person sitting across the table feel about this? And if you can start reading some of those cues, then I think you're communicating at this deeper, more meaningful level where you may not offend and you may get something done. You may actually communicate something more sincere than just the very, very pragmatic. And I think sometimes when we ignore that, we're saying words, but we're not really communicating. We think we might be accomplishing something, but we're just kind of moving something mm-hmm. forward a little bit. We're pushing something down the road, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Gosh, there's so much to this topic.
Yes.
I feel like we need 7 more hours to really cover it all, but lots of stuff to talk about. We're talking about communication tonight, especially the way we're talking to each other around social and civic issues here in an election year, because I think we can all agree, no matter how you are voting, I think we can all agree that we're not in a very polite place right now. So we're challenging that a little bit, and we're thinking through it. And of course, we're joined by our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, who helps us think about why we act the way we do. And we're always happy to have him with us. We're going to take a little break and come back and keep having this conversation all about communication here on 720 WGN.
Netflix has now become a streaming video colossus, bestriding the world with fabulous original programming that has totally transformed the way we watch TV. How did you know? There's a lot of other companies that either fought this or decided, you know what, it's never going to happen because the cable companies aren't going to let it happen. They're our enemy. It'll be too expensive.
You know, I think when you see the internet, you see the growth of these companies like Uber and Amazon in every sector. It's not just us. The internet allows just incredible consumer experiences, and so we're willing to bet on that.
WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. Tonight, we're talking all about communication. My friends, that is a big, big topic, and there's a lot to talk about around that. So to help us, we have our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, with us. Of course, check out his podcast on WGN Plus. It is very good. Very, very smart things happening on that podcast, so be sure you check it out. Lots of cool things coming up on that show, of course. But we're talking with him about the way we communicate with each other, because that's sort of your business. That's sort of your thing.
That's the thing.
You work on every day is helping
people.
If that's
not happening in the room, that's no good.
Right. Yeah. That means you're doing your job right when you get people communicating. So, you know, we've talked a lot about like the interpersonal, the relationship part, but one I think that we haven't talked about as much, although we've tiptoed up to it a little bit on social media, and that's workplace, where you can't necessarily be quite as open as you can at home and with your close relationships, friends and partners and things like that. In particular, buzzwords. Because I think they're a fascinating thing. One day, I keep saying one day I'm going to write a book about buzzwords. Because I think they're a weird, and I tend to overthink, and that's what I do. But I'm always trying to analyze things. And it seems like buzzwords have an interesting role. Because on one hand, it is shorthand to say, I am part of this club. I understand this industry and I'm a part of that. I hear that because, I mean, nowhere is that more obvious than in journalism. So I get it. We have our own language for everything. And most of it has to do with speed to convey information. So there is a time and place for buzzwords. But I think especially when we look at like marketing firms and tech startups, we hear language that has the opposite effect. It communicates to other people in that sector, I am one of your people. Mm-hmm. But I think outside, it communicates, you are not part of this. You don't have a seat at this table. But I think, and tell me if I'm on the right track here, but it seems like buzzwords also have the potential to be very exclusive to people and prevent them from joining, from getting a seat at the table, preventing them from having that conversation. And sometimes I think it even has an even worse effect that we don't even know what the heck we're talking about half the time.
Right. Well, there's a couple. First of all, what a brilliant observation, right? You are so right about that. You know, we create these shorthand elements and this lingo in almost every business. And I noticed that marketing and there's some certain other businesses that really focus on buzzwords. And there is this kind of elitism, exclusivity to the whole thing. And it does cut a whole, well, maybe everybody else out of the communication. One problem I've always had with buzzwords is I'm not much for incomplete communication, and there's nothing more incomplete than buzzwords, you know, because there's this presumption that we all get what it means, right?
Right.
And yet I would guess that, you know, a lie detector strapped to them, you know, you get eight marketers and they might say something very different about a specific buzzword, you know what I mean? So I am always in favor of a little more communication than less. It's about the only significant issue I have with social media is sometimes it doesn't present the opportunity or we don't take the opportunity to communicate a little more completely. But certainly in industry, in most every industry with the buzzwords, I think it creates this shorthand that might be inappropriate at times and presumptuous. And so we are under-communicating or sometimes miscommunicating altogether.
I think we're miscommunicating a lot.
Yeah.
One time I was so fed up in a meeting years ago that tons of people in the room, probably 20 people in the room, and everybody like heads are nodding and these buzzwords are, and I was like, I have no idea what this person is saying. I do not. And I was just given a task and I don't know what it is.
Right, right.
I'm going to look like an idiot if I don't ask. So I'm going to look like an idiot and ask.
Right.
And I raised my hand and I said, I don't know what that word is you just said. And the word was Goldilocking.
And I'll admit, I don't know what Goldilocking is either.
Who does? Right. And the room looked at me like very, not surprised and horror, but you know, people looked at me like, that's interesting. You have a problem with that word. After, privately, people came out, they're like, thank you for saying that. I had no idea what we were talking about.
How about that?
Turns out Goldilocking means we have a couple of choices, but one of them is right.
Huh.
Would you have ever thought that? Sure.
No, I never would have thought that.
I also think it's easier to just say we have a few choices here.
Right.
Maybe one is right. Why are we saying Goldilocking? Same person said calendarizing instead of looking at our, like, scheduling something, and performancing. So I think that on some level, maybe we're just making up words to try to sound
right
smarter.
I think that's probably true. From another era of my life, I'm a recovering CPA.
Ah.
And there were so many buzzwords around that I can remember being in meetings and feeling just like you're describing, absolutely, completely lost. I think most of us were, but because it was a partner or a manager or somebody in charge kind of leading the discussion, we did a lot of nodding. And, you know, so I would guess that there's a lot of inefficiency mm-hmm. affiliated. You know, it probably affects the bottom line in some negative way.
I'm sure it does. There should be a study on this if right. there's not one already. Oh, so many things, you guys. So many things all about communication. And that's the topic tonight on the Saturday Night Special. We're talking about communication, platforms, words, styles, and how it changes in what setting we're in, who we're talking to, all of those things. Lots to get into. And again, we need like 7 more hours to do it, but we're going to do our best tonight to talk about it as much as we possibly can. But my friends, it is 8 o'clock. So let's get you to news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, it's Amy Guth, and indeed, this is the Saturday Night Special. Tonight, we're talking all about communication. Oh boy, is that a big topic. There's so much to get into with that topic. So we have our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, with us. You know him. You love him. You've read stuff he's written. You've seen him on Steve Harvey. He's everywhere, and he's always got such great advice, always so thoughtful, and he's so good at breaking it down for us. So we're always happy to have him with us. But in this topic of communication, as we've been talking about platforms and that we use to communicate with each other and interpersonally, where things go haywire and where things thrive, and how we talk to each other, especially in an election year, we have to stop and say there are an interesting piece of communication is bigger narratives. And as we think about, you know, the popular narratives about things, I am reminded of Chimamanda Adichie's very beautiful TED Talk about the danger of a single story that is so beautiful. And if you have not seen it, I highly recommend it. It is a wonderful, wonderful story. And I have been thinking a lot about that this week in putting together this show, because I think it's very important that we also consider that with every main narrative, with every big topic that we're talking about, particularly in an election year, there are many, many pieces of it and many narratives around it. And so I thought we would call in another expert to talk about that. We're joined now by Frances Negron Muntaner. She is an award-winning filmmaker, writer, curator, scholar, and professor at Columbia University, and does so many interesting pieces of work around race and ethnicity. And in particular, there is an interesting report that she's recently co-authored that I want to talk about. But welcome to the program, Frances.
Really happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Well, so I want to start by talking about the Latino Media Gap report that you co-authored, because it is so very interesting. It's long. I read every single page of it because I was so fascinated by all the information in there. And it covers a lot about the narratives that we use around race when we're thinking not only about television and film, but also in news broadcasts, the way we are all talking about different groups of people. So if you would, please give us just kind of an overview about the Latino Media Gap report.
Sure. The Latino Media Gap is one of three reports that I've been working on. That was the first one that was released. And the aim of it was to give us a panoramic, comprehensive view of what had been the participation of Latinos in media from the 40s in film and from the 50s in television to the present. And one of the, of course, the most surprising things that we found that's reflected in the title is that while the level of population grows and has grown substantially over the last few decades of Latinos in America, the level of representation in the media has actually decreased from the 40s, 50s, and 70s.
Has decreased.
So one of the things that decreased, yes. Yeah. So if you use the measure of population as a measure of inclusion, so you would think, all things being equal, the more people in the population, the more you would see them in the media, but that's actually not the case. So, for instance, in the 40s, you had larger per capita representation of Latinos in movies. And part of the reason for that was because Washington told Hollywood that they needed to make more and friendlier entertainment featuring Latinos due to the war. So Hollywood responded by providing more opportunities for Latino talent. This is the era of Carmen Miranda, Maria Montes, and other Dolores del Rio, stars of that period. Then in the 70s, that kind of wanes after the war, and then you kind of think go back to quote-unquote normal. And then during the 70s, you see a spike in the Latino representation on television, and this time it's not coming from above, this time it's coming from below. The civil rights movement, including the Latino civil rights movement, are seeing media as a political issue and representation as a civil right, and they're pressuring both news and entertainment to be more inclusive.
How that is so very interesting, how, you know, the ways in which television and film are I don't want to say manipulated, but are influenced anyway by outside forces, either directly or indirectly. And so what is the situation now given your expertise? We've talked about 30s, 40s, 50s, but then also 70s and how that shifted. But what was your report's findings for right now?
So after the 70s, again, once these social movements, wane a bit and reform and look different, and there's also a backlash to the civil rights movement during the 80s, you see that things again go down, the black representation goes down again. And I would say it's not until the last decade that you have, as a result of Latinos being recognized as the quote-unquote largest minority group in the United States. So now there's much bigger numbers than before. There's also a recognition that Latinos are a substantial market for media. And if you think of the key demographic, the 18 to 34 key demographic of advertisers, Latinos are actually even more represented. So Latinos are 18% of the larger population. They're also over 25% of the that demographic of advertisers. And if you look at the top 10 markets, Latinos are sometimes half of the population of those markets, like in L.A. So there is both increased pressure from advocates who now see that they have strength in numbers, so these things have to change. And then you have a little bit more willingness from some networks and studios. Not all, I would have to say. So from some. ABC, I think, being one of the primary ones that shifted their business model to include much more diversity in their lineup. So I would say that right now what we see is that some outlets, particularly on television, have become a bit more diverse. The numbers are still incredibly low, though, particularly when you look at behind the camera. We're still talking about 7, 6, 5% when you look at producers, writers, directors. In front of the camera, it's gotten a little better, and I think that's in part because that's what the consumer sees. And the bottom line for the media is to reach that consumer. And then in film, it's a little different because the business model of film is completely international. So the fact that Hollywood films now have a huge investment in that their movies be seen in China and India and Brazil and in other markets outside the United States is actually reshaping. Has reshaped the film industry, so you see even less diversity in some ways there, except for international major directors like Cuarón or Iñárritu, who are able to make work at the top of the highest levels in Hollywood, but that's not common, particularly for people born in the United States.
You know, one aspect of the report that you co-authored, the Latino Media Gap report, that I found also very interesting, because you talk about both television and film industries, but also news media and narratives that get stirred and perpetuated as a result of how different groups of people are depicted on news, or how which stories cover which people. And I think that is especially pertinent right now in an election year, when we have a major party candidate talking a lot about groups of people in not particularly positive ways. So talk to us about that a bit.
Absolutely. But if I were to draw a list of what was the most urgent, I would say news would probably be number one. First of all, although, as we have said, Latinos are about 18% of the population, and in some cities more than half of the population, news coverage of Latinos is under 2%. So of all the stories, or thousands of stories that are on television, several hundred are about 2%, less than 2%, 1.8%, are featuring Latinos. And then when you break those stories down, so there's few stories, what are they about? So the vast majority of these stories are about illegality, either drug dealing, sexual crimes, or undocumented immigration. So the picture that most people get about who are Latinos in America, first, that they are not very important to the larger narrative, as you were mentioning earlier, and second, that they're bad people, that they're, in a way, bad news for America. So you see that being played out in the elections when you have major candidates that are able to seize on that as the common knowledge of the population, of everyone. And then people believe then that the U.S. is under siege from undocumented immigrants, or that the immigrants are the cause of many of the United States problems.
And so is the answer to combating that, is that about newsroom diversity? Is that about media literacy of consumers, or all those things, or something else entirely, in order to fix that and right-size that?
Well, I would say that in our analysis, we distinguish between, for some sense, between micro and macro, right? So in the micro, it does have to do with hiring, diversity. It has to do with, literally who's in the room when a big news item breaks out, and what angles are developed, like how is it framed, and also to define what is news. So the more diversity and points of view that you have in the newsroom, the more diverse you're probably going to get in the stories and how they're told and from what angle. But in the macro, I think there's another thing that's a bit even more complicated than that, which has to do with the persistent, view in the United States that Latinos are really not part of the history of the United States. And that the only frame that makes sense of the massive presence of Latinos in the United States is recent immigration. And I think you can see that even in the efforts that in the Democratic Convention, there were many efforts and many moments where there were references to Latinos as part of this coalition. But if you look at the videos, and if you look at who spoke and what they spoke about, very rarely did you actually have stories where it was suggested Latinos had contributed to American politics, or that there have been Latinos in the territory called the United States even before there was a United States. So until Latinos are no longer seen as just foreigners, recently arrived, I think we will have issues as a country integrating the story of Latinos.
So an interesting thing that's also noted in the Latino Media Gap report that you co-authored is the idea that's almost a positive that came out of a negative, and that is, as a result of a large degree of exclusion from traditional media, or maybe a negative depiction, or just not a fair shot, there's been interesting and innovative uses of new media.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the two groups that are the biggest consumer producers of, let's say, consumer media online, they're precisely two groups that are fairly marginalized in mainstream media, which are Latinos and Asian Americans. So in that regard, I think that the fact of exclusion and marginality has made Latinos be particularly avid not only consumers of media online, but also producers of media online. So in that regard, you could think of it as Latinos might be a little bit ahead of the curve in that regard, in that they're early, Latinos are early adopters of new technology, and they use them for purposes of self-representation and, you know, public engagement, to engage in conversations and to start conversations and see things from a different angle. Yet, the fact is that even though we know that there's a lot of eyeball migration, you know, from mainstream media to online, there's still a major footprint from traditional media, studios and networks in the internet. So we're still looking at a landscape that, whereas, yes, you have high levels of participation online, but that's combined with low levels of participation elsewhere. So we're still in a very uneven and unequal landscape.
So I want to shift a little bit, because here we are in an election year, and so many conversations having to do with this election have gone to a conversation about centering around race. And as we're focused on communication tonight, and I think a lot of people get very tripped up talking about that and talking about race and how to not perpetuate narratives that are false, or that are, how to outthink dominant narratives, or include stories in the main narrative that might be excluded just by rote, right? What does the path to that look like for the average citizen outside of journalism, outside of academia, but just the average media consumer? What is the path to using more inclusive language in their communication?
You mean between each other?
Yeah.
I think part of it is that, and I guess this is something that comes, with the territory of someone who's a scholar, but anything that sounds too simple is probably not true.
Right, right.
We live in an extremely complex world. So when someone tells you that the cause of, that some Americans are experiencing a more hardship economically is immigrants. That is the cause of that. That is a simple explanation to an extremely complex question. So that should give people pause, right? I think when there is a debate, we should pay attention to who's framing it. And what's at stake in this framing, and whether it is truly integrating all the possible complications and complexities of the matter, right? So for instance, we should interrogate why some people hear Black Lives Matter as your life doesn't matter, because that's not what they're saying, So why is it that some people hear that way? And then interrogate it, bring it up as a question. And I think part of what would make perhaps our society a bit more open and a bit more open to different stories would be precisely that attitude of questioning. Let's look into this a little bit more. Let's not take for granted what is being presented to us, because there's a lot of interest both at the level of selection of what we're listening to and who's speaking, and there's a disproportionate amount of space and time that certain sectors of society get to do that others don't. And we need to take that into account when we're weighing in on the argument. Who's not being heard? Is a question that we should always be asking ourselves.
Yeah, who is not being heard? I think that's such a key point, truly, that can really diffuse a lot of conversations that get so very heated. And I think earlier what Dr. Duffy was saying, talking about fear and ego and judgment getting in the way when we're having difficult conversations, when we're not being fully present, when we're not fully listening to each other. I think that gets very wrapped up in this too, in a political landscape, and we're having these heated conversations. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, Francis Negron-Muntaner, filmmaker, award-winning filmmaker, I should say, writer, curator, scholar, and professor at Columbia University, and our good friend at the Op-Ed Project. Thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. All right, my friends, we are going to take a break here in just a bit. When we come back, we are going to continue this conversation all about communication, because as we have gotten this far in the program, I think it is clear to us all there's just so much to get into, so much to unpack, so much to consider. And I really encourage us to do so with, if we rewind to what our good friend Dr. John Duffy was saying earlier, to listen to each other and say, who is not included in this conversation? Who is not being represented? And I think my hunch is, if we could possibly consider having conversations, especially the difficult ones, especially in this political climate that we're in, and really checking fear, ego, and judgment, as he described, I think these conversations might start to shift. I might be oversimplifying it, but that is my hope. But we're going to take a little break and be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Netbooks aren't better at anything. They're slow, they have low quality displays, and they run clunky old PC software. So they're not better than a laptop at anything. They're just cheaper. They're just cheap laptops. And we don't think that they're a third category device. But we think we've got something that is. It's so much more intimate than a laptop, and it's so much more capable than a smartphone with this gorgeous large display. And we'd like to show it to you today for the first time. And we call it the iPad.
WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We are talking all about communication. So we had to dig up that iPad announcement. Do you remember when that happened? I think everybody thought it was going to be the iTablet, and like no one thought it was going to be the iPad. What? It sounds like a tablet of paper. What? Everybody was so confused. And yet now, oh my gosh, they're everywhere. Even to the extent they're so ubiquitous now that I recently read kind of a lighthearted but very serious op-ed by a wedding photographer that said, please leave this junk at home. You're killing my wedding pictures because you all hold up iPads and iPhones as soon as the bride walks down the aisle. And it makes for a super ugly picture. Don't do that, which is so funny. Well, tonight we're talking all about communication, my friends. And so we have our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, with us. We were just talking with the very, very brilliant Frances Negron Muntaner. She is a professor at Columbia, and she talks and researches and teaches and does all this work around race and the media that's so very, very interesting and that I'm really drawn to. And of course, she is connected to us through the Op-Ed Project's Public Voices Fellowship. Many, many wonderful minds come to this program from that program. So we're happy to be connected with them. And we've got a couple of text messages, too, that I want to share with you from the 630 area code. Amy, I could not benefit from a format more than what you chose tonight. That's in all caps with an exclamation point.
Hey, hey.
Dr. Duffy hits it on the head. When I hear he has something to say, I am all ears. So, so sensible. Great show, hon. Thank you. Well,
oh,
thank
nice.
You, 630 area code. I'm very grateful for that and for you for taking the time to say that. And from the 847, I think listening is a crucial, if not the most important, aspect of communication, more specifically, reflective listening. It's not just repeating the other person's words back to him or her, but rather just reflecting back to let her know she has been heard. It is so valuable to be more quiet and to slow down and to listen than to try to rush in and announce your opinion. That is so true.
So true. Yeah. I mean, such an understated concept, right? Reflective listening.
I think so many people are just sitting there listening. Okay, when do I talk? When can I talk?
Yep.
Are you going to stop talking so I can talk?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got my point. It's ready to go.
Ready to go. As soon as you're done,
packaged.
I'm going to say a thing. I'm going to say a thing. And you can always tell because they'll go, right. And they'll just like jump back in. I'm grateful for those texts. Thank you all so much for sending them. And of course, you can give us a call too, 312-981-7200.
That is what Barack and I think about every day as we try to guide and protect our girls through the challenges of this unusual life in the spotlight. How we urge them to ignore those who question their father's citizenship or faith. How we insist that the hateful language they hear from public figures on TV does not represent the true spirit of this country. how we explain that when someone is cruel or acts like a bully, you don't stoop to their level. No, our motto is, when they go low, we go high.
WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking all about communication, particularly how we are communicating with each other in an election year, because I think we can all agree we are not being all that polite and sweet and kind and accepting of one another. I think we all both teams think the other team is an idiot, is made up of idiots, and both parties think the other candidate is an idiot or terrible or whatever. And we're saying awful things about each other and the way we vote. And that's fine to think that, but we're not changing minds by calling each other idiots. We're not fostering dialogue. I might even suggest we're making it worse and not having any dialogue at all and just calling each other big stupid idiot all the time. So we're talking all about communication, especially around the election. And we have our good friend, Dr. John Duffy, with us tonight in studio. And we are joined on the phone by our other good friend and regular contributor to this program, Rex Hupke from the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Rex. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely a pleasure.
Glad you could make it. And you had it looks like a very big time at the RNC week before last, and you were very, very busy there. And I was watching everything you were doing on social media. You were sharing, you were talking about what you were doing and what you were seeing there at the Republican National Convention. And I was also very interested in the responses that you were getting and the dialogue around what you were doing, because I don't know that a lot of communication was happening, but it sure seemed like a lot of people had a lot of very strong opinions about what you were doing. So talk to us about communication you were having at the actual event and online.
Yeah, that's an interesting subject. I don't know. Not exactly sure if it was really a dialogue. Now, I will say, for one thing, I was under normal circumstances, I'm not very, I don't engage in a whole lot of back and forth on Twitter, for example, which is my main outlet, mm-hmm. social media wise. And at the RNC, I had very little time at all, but I was able to at least see kind of the responses to things, certainly. And it's a mix. I write a funny tweet about poking fun at something that happened at the convention, and the anti-Trump people, of course, love it and retweet, send around, respond, hurrah, all that. And then the pro-Trump people eventually get in on the game and get defensive either by insulting me or, honestly, one of the most common things that I'm seeing, and I see it in the email that I get off columns I write as well, is not a discussion in which you say, no, you're wrong, and here's why. The more common response is, well, and I mean from a Trump supporter standpoint, is well, but Hillary Clinton did this, this, and this. So we seem to be engaging in a lot of, and that goes both ways as well.
Yeah.
So that's not just, and in fact, I do that too. I mean, if as a critic of Trump, I have caught myself on several occasions when somebody has said something about Clinton, saying, oh, well, good grief, compared to Trump, what do you, that sort of thing. And that's and that's bad. I mean, and I am guilty of that as well. But that, I think, some of this may have to do with our easy access to huge amounts of information. But it's very easy now to, rather than come up with a legitimate response to a complaint or a criticism, it is to say, oh, yeah, but look at what he did or look at what she did. And I would argue that is a discussion that leads absolutely nowhere.
Well, it is an interesting technique that actually has been brought up a lot lately. There was just a piece in The Atlantic recently that was dealing with history and race. It was particularly, it was written by someone who used to work at a historic site. And it was like a plantation home, and would say, and this person had slaves, and would talk about that. And it was like people wanted to like soften that or not take it in somehow by saying, yeah, but no one was abused here. Right, well, okay, but people are still slaves. Like, let's not get away from that, right? Like, wait a minute, what are you trying to do exactly? And it was so interesting in this story that this person wrote was how time and time again people go, oh yeah, but it couldn't possibly be what you say because of this fact or this thing I believe, which was so fascinating that I see again and again as we're having this political conversation. And the thing, I mean, I think we've been saying this the whole show, there's no one's ever been like, oh, good point, I am going to vote for your guy. Like at no
That's
point,
the problem.
Right,
yeah.
None of it changes anybody's mind. We just, I think our, I mean, I worry about our communication right now in the world and especially in this country very much. I lose a lot of sleep over our communication and our media literacy. I think elections sometimes might be halfway decided on email forwards written in Comic Sans sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's horrible. I agree. I think what's happening now, because you're right, there is not, you have two wildly divisive candidates. And I've been critical of Hillary Clinton as well. And I think there are ample arguments that people who don't like her can make about elements of her past and things she has done and decisions she's made. So I think what's happening now, I don't think you're going to necessarily convince very many people to vote for Hillary. I think in some ways what people are trying to do is convince people to not vote for Trump,
right.
which and that results in either a go to a libertarian or just don't vote in the presidential part of the election and worry about down ballot people, which, you know, isn't an unreasonable thing to do, but necessarily. I think there's an effectiveness to calling Trump out on things that are particular because he's so far outside of any sort of political norms and borderline social norms at times, as we've seen today, certainly. I think calling him out on that, I think there is a value to that still, because I think that does get people to think, like, can you actually support this? Is this really where you want to go? And I think that's a question a lot of Republicans are asking themselves as they decide what exactly to do with it.
So something that's been on my mind a lot that I think is a difficult one. I mean, this one is tough because it is very easy, and I'm hearing this a lot about Trump supporters. It's very easy to say, to kind of dismiss Trump supporters as, as a they. I hear a lot of people say, you know, they, but then the same thing is happening. Like people are calling Democrats they, but in particular, I'm hearing a lot of people talking about Trump supporters in a way that is almost subhuman. And again, I would say Trump supporters are not a people that are speaking for me. I'll say that. But nonetheless, I think it's very easy for us to say things like idiots or how, you know, and like really dismissive stuff. But I can't stop thinking about the idea that maybe the complaint of bigotry is being fought with more bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really weighing. I mean, it is challenging if you passionately disagree with someone and you think that they perhaps have their head where the sun doesn't shine. It is difficult and it is really challenging to make yourself say, okay, why is someone thinking that? Like, what is it someone believes? If they believe very strongly in this candidate that I don't support, what can I say besides what an idiot, right? Like, how can I make myself say, okay, this person is intelligent and believes they are doing the right thing. I don't think, like, I'm not hitting the mark 100% of the time. I admit that fully, but that's something I'm trying to make myself do anytime I encounter opposition of any kind. But I keep noticing that there's, and one thing I noticed is that a lot of times when people are mimicking a Trump supporter, they do it with a Southern accent. I'm from the South. And so that is particularly, that bothers me because there's a wide range of people in the South and I'm related to some of them and I, you know, care deeply for many of them and they don't represent, you know, there's not just one type of person in the South. So I think that's an interesting topic, right? Because it's challenging. It's really challenging. If you say, okay, self, I'm going to try to find what it is that makes someone believe as they do rather than just say, what an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, and what that we could all be that thoughtful, which I completely agree with. And I will say, at the Republican National Convention, I spent a lot of time watching the convention itself, which was a great example, as any convention is, of kind of a groupthink, and everybody, you know, and at the Republican one, they're chanting, you know, lock her up, and there's a lot of anger, and there's a lot of negativity. However, I would go outside, and I'd walk around in the arena, you know, the passageways and stuff, and I would talk to people and interview them for columns I was writing, and to a person could not have been nicer, and to a person could not have been more reasonable. And I disagreed with them on many things, but they were not I would not call these people racist by any means. And that's not everybody. I mean, you know, look, there's racists among them, absolutely, and there's racists, and there's bad people among people at the Democratic Convention, too. So I don't mean to,
sure,
you know, overly broad brush or overly puff up the individuals. Obviously, I was speaking to, you know, a variety of people over the course of 4 days. But my point is, when you actually say, you get a bunch of people together, liberal or conservative or whatever, and there's going to be kind of a groupthink thing happening, you pull people apart and you talk to them one-on-one, and you can actually get to know them a little bit and understand better where they're coming from. So I spoke with people who, I spoke with a pro-choice Republican who supports Trump, not really because he necessarily wants to, but because he feels very strongly about certain issues, like the Second Amendment related issues, other things that could come up before the Supreme Court. And so he cares about the Supreme Court justices. I spoke with some other folks who, again, maybe didn't start out supporting Trump, but they're doing it, and they're doing it for very specific reasons. And the reasons were very rarely, I love Trump and I love everything he says. It was more, I really don't like Hillary Clinton, and I feel like, regardless of the bluster, Trump's going to figure this out, and blah, blah, blah. So again, things that I couldn't walk away from those conversations and fully agree, but I certainly could understand where they're coming from. And, you know, people I would, lovely people who I'd easily hang out with and go, you know,
yeah.
And it wasn't just me. I mean, I saw African-American reporters, I saw Latino reporters. Everybody there was getting along very well. And now those are slightly artificial conditions and that sort of thing. But still, you know, it is wrong. It is wrong to say all Trump supporters are bad people or whatever, or to certainly to talk, make them speak in a Southern accent, which I agree is also really terrible in its own right.
Right, right. My friends, we're talking with Chicago Tribune's Rex Hupke, who was recently at the Republican National Convention. And tonight we're talking all about communication, particularly with how we talk with each other in an election year about the topics that matter to us. And as Rex was just describing, walking around, talking to people one-on-one, it's bringing to mind the idea of when people are badly trolled online, how when they confront their abusers, how it's a very different story. It was like, oh, I was just messing with you, sorry. So we are gonna take a quick break, and we come back, we're gonna keep talking with our good friend Rex Hupke, and with our good friend Dr. John Duffy, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Saturday Night Special, and tonight we are talking all about communication. Oh, my friends, there is so much to talk about when we think about that topic. There's how we talk with each other and the people that we love and the people in our lives that are close to us. There's how to talk with our coworkers, and then we add in all these platforms, right? Anything from the phone to text to social media and all this stuff. But then layer in another piece, and that is, boom, it's an election year, and people have got some strong opinions about what they think. And when you put all of that stuff together, we're in a spot where we're maybe not having very thoughtful dialogue with each other. So we brought in the big guns tonight. We are having big, big experts here with us. We've got Dr. John Duffy with us in studio. A little bit earlier, we talked with a Columbia University professor who has devoted her entire work to talking about narratives around race and media and all of that, and had a really thoughtful conversation with her that I really, really enjoyed. And now we have our good friend and regular contributor to the program, Rex Hupke, on the phone with us, who was recently at the Republican National Convention and writes a great deal about politics and the social issues attached to this election. And you know, Rex, one thing I want to talk about is the difference that it was highlighted just this past week in Michelle Obama's speech, which I thought was very powerful. And that was just the difference in communication styles from the two candidates and their entire campaigns. And when I say campaigns, I include supporters in that, because you know, you set the, you, the candidate, sets the tone, the way your supporters are going to, you know, talk about your issues and talk about your running for office. And I think they could not be more different, but I thought Michelle Obama really, really, nailed that without nailing it. She didn't use the word Trump one time in her speech, which I thought was so interesting. You know, I loved when they go low, we go high. I mean, she was really just saying there's a lot of, you know, a lot of things coming out of the Trump campaign, and let's talk about some positive things. Now, on the other side of that, I value diversity of conversation. And so I don't unfriend people on Facebook when they disagree with me, even though that's every single day in this election cycle. I have gone to Facebook and I see somebody that I know saying, oh my gosh, I just unfriended a bunch of people because of this. I like that, as long as we're polite to each other and respect each other. But, you know, and so some Trump supporters that I know say something very different. They say, I feel like that in fact, I think there's a lot of real talk coming out of the Trump campaign, and the rest is lip service and politicking, which that's valid. That's valid. You know, it's not the way I see it, but that's valid if that's what someone believes. But I can't help but really, with great interest, I'm trying to imagine the debates, because holy moly, I mean, two very different communication styles here. But I want to back that up a little bit to the reporter part. Because I have seen so many reporters, and the way campaign fans and supporters have been reacting to reporters has been very interesting to me. And do you feel like that's different in this cycle?
Yes, there is. I had to think about that for a second, but I think there is a higher level of hostility, and you've seen it very much on the Democratic side too, with Bernie Sanders and his supporters. But I mean, maybe I have argued every step of the way here since the early stages, that frankly, that in terms of online vitriol, the Bernie Sanders supporters were every bit what the Trump supporters are in terms of just getting riled up and trolling people. Yeah. And so I don't think that is a unique to Donald Trump. And again, there are, I know plenty of people who have complained about Hillary supporters going after them right and left, accusing them of sexism and various other things. You know, if they make any kind of critique of Hillary Clinton, and I don't mean like an inappropriate, I mean, you know, a legitimate critique. So, yeah, so there is a high level of sensitivity all over the place. I feel like everybody's nerves are very raw in this emotion, and in this election, rather. And
but when this emotion's
right. Emotion,
that's right.
I can't even say it.
Right. Well, you know, right before we came back, Rex, right before we came back, Dr. John Duffy and I were talking, and you said a word, Dr. Duffy, that I thought was really important when we were talking about, Rex, your particular, you know, your writing style and your voice.
Well, yeah. Hi, Rex. It's John Duffy, and I stalk you liberally on Twitter. So one thing I notice, a purpose you serve, I think, for us Chicagoans is you bring levity to the process. And I think that's so critical. And I think about other campaigns in the past, and I think it shows the mettle of a campaign when they can handle that without a real thin skin and don't kind of attack the reporter or the other candidate and just kind of like roll with it. And I noticed like with your work that you personally are getting attacked on a pretty liberal basis. And I've just wondered if that's any different than it was 4 years ago or eight.